This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With the Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Okay, well, I am so thrilled today to welcome to Joy on Paper Paulina Simmons, who is the author of The Tiger Catcher. Wow, this is a new trilogy that she has come out with, and it's called The End of Forever Saga. And this is the first book, and the second book is coming out soon, too. So I am so really excited to welcome Paulina to the program today. Hi, Paulina.
Hello, Patsy. How are you?
Oh, wow. I tell you, this is exciting. You have a trilogy, and it's interesting how it's coming out. Just 2 months apart between the first book and the second book, so which is quite unusual.
It is quite unusual. We were trying to figure out, because we have the books. I guess that's the difference. Most of the time, when people they write the first book, and then when it's published, they take the time to then write the second book and so on. But I actually spent 5 years writing these books and working on them, and so we have them, and we already knew we had them. We said, what is the best way to give them to my readers? And we did think about doing a more conventional sort of publishing plan, where The Tiger Catcher would come out, and then a year later A Beggar's Kingdom would come out, and so on. But we just thought that by the time they sort of read the first book, that they would be quite impatient to get on with the story. And certainly, by the time you have in your hands and read the second book, you will not want to wait 5 seconds before reading the book.
I agree. I mean, why torture your fans?
Yes,
get it out there, because I will tell you one thing. If the fans knew that you were sitting on it, then they would get upset, because once they finish this book, they definitely are eager for the second one.
Well,
and as you said, the third one, woo!
Well, think about it, like how we feel about where no name shall be named, but say we're waiting for a sixth book in a certain saga that someone else has written, and we've been waiting and waiting for years and years, and the gentleman still has not given it to us because he's still writing it. But what if we knew that he already had finished it and was just waiting to, you know, to publish it? With riot.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So you did the right thing, because, as you said, once people start reading you, well, of course, you know, you are such a fabulous author, and this new trilogy, it's really funny. I lived in England for quite a few years, and so when when I started the prologue, and I don't know, you know, I went through Liverpool Station so many times I can't even imagine, and going to the observatory, and so I'm right there in this prologue. The minute I started reading, I was just caught up with your writing. I said, oh, and I was so happy that more of the story takes place in England, because...
Well, so much of it, and Patsy, but I'm like you, because I lived in England myself, and I have been waiting my whole writing life, 25 years, to find a story that was worthy of a town, a city like London, and it took me this long. I couldn't just set a story in London. It had to be a story that was worthy of that city, and finally I found it. Believe me, London plays a huge, huge part in Julian and Josephine's adventures. It's almost like a character in itself in their story.
That's true, and that's why, you know, I think for anyone who loves London like I do, of course, we are walking the streets with you. We've been to these places, and it's so exciting. But then, because your writing is so deep and so really graphic, you take anybody who hasn't been to London yet will feel like they are walking with you in London.
Yes, and I thank you for that. I work quite hard to make it vivid for myself so that when I read it, it sort of becomes real to me. And I do hope that that it does become real to my readers also.
Well, the idea is fantastic. And as I said, I just love the way it opened up in the Royal Observatory, where I went many times. And so I know that I know the area so well. I spent like maybe 50% of my time at the British Museum Library.
Yes.
And then
amazing because the British Museum plays a very large part in the later part of the story in the Beggar's Kingdom.
I know, and I was one of those people. I was very fortunate. I had a reader's card, and I was there when it was still a working library. I hate that they've covered it with glass it just makes me so angry.
Yeah,
but I love the library. I spent hundreds of hours doing research in that library, and so
you're a true scholar, a true reader. Then you understand how important these things are, how important the physical location is to sometimes understanding the metaphysical story behind it.
Exactly, and that's why I want everybody to know that when they're reading this book, and it's transporting you to this wonderful, wonderful places in London. Wow, it's amazing. But of course, it also has Los Angeles. A lot of the story takes place in Los Angeles.
Exactly. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, that's okay, because I also worked in Los Angeles. I used to write scripts, and so I know that side very well too. So this was a really double treat for me.
Right, so I said it structured it that way so that as we begin it, aside from the prologue, that we begin it in a sort of fairy tale. There is a certain rose-colored hue to the part that's set in L.A., and then we get to London, and it's a little bit more, gritty, more realistic, like you said, maybe more graphic. But then, as you read, you will see that even London becomes like a fairy tale also. You know, that even the sort of the dirt and the grime and the that full sort of full-bodied, all different multi-layered, faceted, multifaceted like magnificence of London becomes its own sort of rose-colored fairy tale.
It does. Well, you know, of course. Now you said you started this 5 years ago. How did you come out with this idea?
The idea came out with me. I didn't come out with the idea. I was sitting very happily, minding my own business, in a dark theater, about to watch a movie. And during the previews for this movie, I saw Julian, and I didn't quite know what I was seeing, but what I saw in my mind's eye was his desperation, his outrage, his very deep love for a woman, and him trying to do something, and also this great feeling of danger, and that his time was running out. His time to do whatever it is he needed to do was running out. So I didn't know what that was, but let me tell you, I didn't see the rest of that movie. I don't even know what it was that we were watching, but at the end of it, I had my entire story. That oak grew in my head, not like an acorn, but like a fully fledged tree.
Oh!
So by the time the 2 hours were done, my whole thing, the Tiger Catcher, A Beggar's Kingdom, and Inexpressible Island, from beginning to end, was already in my head.
I know that
so what
feeling.
I recommend, yeah.
It's wonderful, isn't it?
Well, it is, but what I recommend is if anyone ever needs a chance to maybe get some new ideas and to think about things, I highly recommend How to Train Your Dragon 2 for that sort of thing. Because that was the movie that I was watching or not watching.
Well, it's funny. This happens sometimes to a writer, and you don't know where it comes from. And it happened to me once in a footnote. I was reading a footnote, and I just followed that footnote a little ways, and then the next thing I know, I had an entire story in my head from beginning to end, just like this. And it's such an exciting thing when the characters, they come full-blown. It's just such a thrill, isn't it?
But that's the thing about it. And there's a saying that there's something to see every place you look. And that's a little bit like your footnote and my movie, is that you don't know from where it's going to come to you. That's why you have to be open to everything, because you just have no idea. That's why you have to look at everything, see everything, read everything. Because, again, it could be in the smallest detail. Something may strike you. And, by the way, it's unique to you, Patsy, because no one else probably would have seen what you saw in that footnote. It's only because your soul saw something and then took it and made a whole new thing out of it, which is like the amazing part.
Well, it is. And I was reading an old book from, 1890s, and that's where I saw that footnote. And everything led from there to really a lot of magic for me, because I now have, my head is full of these people, and I just love it. Yes. Just like I'm sure that you now, let's talk a little bit about Julian and some of the characters that you developed, well, that came to you around him.
Yeah. Well, so Julian came to me first, and I knew that he had a life. So really, though, I mean, it is Julian and Josephine's story, but it is Julian's quest. And so my entire trilogy is told from Julian's point of view. Originally, I actually thought of writing it in first person male, and then decided to give myself more flexibility not to do that and to write it in third person male. But it's still, that's something that I've never done before. So in that respect, this trilogy is in this one way different from my other books. In many other ways, it's quite similar to my other novels, because of the emotion, the adventure, the danger, the love, the passion, the heartbreak, all of that is in this book. But the male point of view is singular. A male point of view is unique to these novels, because I've certainly done, I have a detective story that I also have done from part male point of view and part female point of view. And my Bronze Horseman books, the five Bronze Horseman books, I've done from multiple points of view, including the male and the female. But in these books, it is really Julian. And so it is his life and how he perceives it and what his soul sees and how his soul sees her. And she becomes real to us through him. And she has her own journey. And that journey includes a lot of very colorful characters. And we are, we're going to meet them all, and they all become, part of the fabric of their adventure. But he himself, Julian, also has these two very important people who help him with his part of the journey, and that is his best friend and this new gentleman who advises him, whom he meets while he's, struggling to recover his life and to rebuild his life. And he meets this gentleman, and this gentleman is the one who helps them find her again. And so then they become sort of reluctant friends, but very deep friends. And so the story is not just a story of love, but it's also a story of this profound friendship between men and what it means to be a friend and what it means for men to be friends, lifelong friends together, because that's a very strong thread that runs through them. And, of course, not only just these men, but the women that love them and the women whom they love, and their struggles with, trying to keep all those balls in the air, trying to do right and be good and sometimes make very bad choices. All of that is in these books, too, not just with Julian, but also with the people that he knows and that surround him.
Well, there are so many things in this book that I just grabbed me. One, because I could relate to so many of the things. One of the, in addition to all the places in London that I really, so many of the places in this book I have been to, and I have walked these streets, and so I know them so well. But I love your references to, like, Leonard Cohen, for example, who is one of,
yes.
I listen to him every day. Every day I listen to Leonard Cohen.
Patsy, you're like a woman after my own heart. Leonard Cohen is a poet, and he also, to read his interviews about his writing process, it just brings me closer to my own work, because when I hear him talk about spending years crafting one of his songs, years, not months, not weeks, but one song, then I realize how deeply he must live inside the lines of his poetry, you know. That's sort of very, very, very moving to me. And I also, he has this marvelous book that I found when I myself was in L.A., and that was his tribute to L.A. when he was living there. And so I really, really enjoyed you know, reading his poetry there. He's quite amazing.
Well, that's why the minute, you know, as I said, there are so many of these moments in the book where I said, oh, wow, because I'm always surprised when people don't know Leonard Cohen, and I get excited when, yeah, I can introduce people to him, because, as I said, I listen to Leonard Cohen every single day. I just, something
that's
about
amazing.
It, some his voice and,
yes,
his words just, oh, take me.
And his words, yeah.
Sometimes just for a few minutes, you listen to him and you say, wow, this is so,
yeah,
deep. It's so heartfelt, and there's such a godliness to it, and it's so exciting.
It's tremendous, because you know that every word that you are reading, he meant for you to read, to see.
Exactly.
Feel, that he worked on it, that it wasn't just something he slapdashed right together. Though, you know, we know that Bob Dylan does not write this way, and Bob Dylan is also a genius. So Bob Dylan has a different way of working, and he does sometimes, you know, write his poetry in a day or two or a week. So he doesn't spend as long as Leonard Cohen does. But there is something very, sort of very, emotionally connecting to Leonard Cohen's poetry.
Well, it's very much like your writing, because you also, you crafted this as well as wrote it from the heart. There's also the part of you as a fine writer. You know, it took you 5 years.
Yes.
I'm sure that you went over this many times so that you would, yeah, you would get us, the reader, into that same emotion that you wanted us to feel, because there's a lot of mystical things in this book, and people have to be, you know, set it, you have to set it up right for people to get the idea, and you certainly,
yes,
have done a,
yes,
great job.
Well, I thank you for that, but you're right. Well, you yourself know also that with research and writing and story writing, you feel something in your head, but to put it on paper the way you see it or the way you feel it takes like a different skill set, I would say. And so I can sometimes see the story, but then when I write it, my first draft, second draft, tenth draft just doesn't look like what I felt or what I saw when it first came to me. And so I have to work it and rework it and rework it until it gets, and sometimes, you know, it still never gets there. Like, perfecting of words is never done. I'm still reading things that I, you know, that I say, oh, this is not right. This isn't quite right. I wish I used a different word or described it in a different way. But it does take a tremendous amount of work and revision to get it to where you can read it and say, hey, I see that. I get that.
Well, that's why I named this program The Joy of Writing. You know, it's really so,
yes,
it just makes you feel so good when you work your words, when you play with them, you write them, and then you go back and all of this part of the revision and the rewriting. And just, it's almost like a game. You're playing it and all of these little nuances. And then you sit back and you say, ooh, I did that. I really found that joy in writing.
Yes, and I love that you call your show Joy on Paper, because for me, if I were to call my show something, I would call it Suffering on Paper or Heartache on Paper or, heartrending misery on paper, because sometimes the joy for me comes when people like you or my readers come to me or write to me and say, oh my goodness, I read your story and I felt it and I cried. That to me is the joy, because until that point, for me, it's such a struggle. It's such an effort to get it right and to obsess about it and to be consumed by not only by the story as a whole, but like you said, even by the individual words and how to best put them together. But when the girl in Poland brings me homemade moonshine and says to me, Paulina, I love your books and here's my gift to you to thank you, then I say it's all worth it.
It's all worth it. Well, I think it's wonderful. I'm so happy that you are releasing them quickly, because it is going to be lots of fun for your readers. And everyone should start with The Tiger Catcher. And then July 23rd, I think, is the release of The Beggar's Kingdom.
A Beggar's Kingdom, and then at Christmas, we're going to have Inexpressible Island.
Okay. Well, maybe at Christmas time, when that third book comes out, you could come back to the program, and we can talk more about the joy of writing and about our joy of London and Los Angeles and all of the places, because there's so much to talk about. And of course, I just want to tell everyone that I think you're an amazing author, and you have a website. People can go there and find out more about you, and it's Paulina, and it's spelled with double L. Paulina.
Yes.
I think it's a Polish or Russian way of doing that, right?
Russian. I was born and raised in Russia, yeah.
Okay, so we can talk about that more. And it's Paulina Simmons, and they can find it, .com. And you have some blog tour giveaways also that people might find intriguing. But I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today, Paulina.
Thank you very much.
I think you've done a terrific job.
Pleasure.
And
thank you so much.
Okay, well, The Tiger Catcher is a fascinating book, and as I said, anyone who reads that will just jump into the second one on the 23rd of July.
I appreciate that. I really enjoyed my conversation with you today. I like the in-depth of it, and I love the fact that we concentrated on the writing. It was great.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
And we'll talk to you around Christmas time, because then everybody can buy the trilogy
as
a Christmas gift.
Wonderful.
Okay. Okay. We'll arrange it.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
All right.
Okay, we're going to go to commercial, and then we'll be right back. And I have another exciting guest coming up.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660, or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back, and I am with my next guest. Okay, I am so happy to welcome to the program Rachel Linden, who has written a fascinating book called The Enlightenment of Bees. Hi, Rachel.
Good morning, Patsy.
Oh, wow. Good morning. It is so nice to welcome you. I was reading about you a little bit, and I just realized that you were homeschooled.
I was homeschooled. That is true.
Okay, because I homeschooled my boys, and I had the best time of my life. I loved homeschooling, and I was so happy with it. And it's so funny when I was homeschooling, people were saying, "Oh, well, I don't know. You know, it's not good for them because they won't be sociable."
I thought, oh yeah, we got that a lot too.
Didn't you? And it's so funny. The homeschool kids. We're always the most sociable because I explained to people, I said, I would not homeschool them if they weren't interesting. I would get rid of them, you know, at 6:30 in the morning like every other mother around here. So I said, if they're not fun to be with, I wouldn't want them. So I had absolutely delightful many, many years of homeschooling. So I thought, I think it does shape a person in many ways.
It does shape a person, and honestly, the thing I loved the most about it was the freedom, because that's when I really started writing. I wrote my first book when I was 12, and homeschooling allowed for that. It allowed for me to take big chunks of time, because I could be done with my schoolwork in a few hours, and then have a lot of time for creative pursuits. And it allowed me to travel more, I think, than most kids in other more normal school contexts, because we could just take off in February and go for 2 weeks to Honduras and do a service project. Or the flexibility was really wonderful.
It was, and we did the same thing. I mean, we could travel to the Civil War sites, and we could go where history took us and learn history on the spot. And it was so much fun. And as you said, you finished when you actually look at it, the number of hours that kids spend in school. So much is wasted because you can finish your schoolwork in 2 hours.
Yes, and so it just allowed for so much more time for creativity and flexibility, which was really wonderful.
And my boys were, it was so funny. their friends would be up and, up at 5:30 on the bus by 6:15 to get to school at 7 o'clock. And my boys were still sleeping, and I could then walk in the, like about 8 o'clock, I'd walk in the bedroom and start singing, "Good morning, good morning," and their whole life was so much different. And as you said, it gave them so much time to read real books instead of, all that stuff they give you in school, which really so much of it is pointless. And by the time they were just little, they were already through all the Hardy Boys and everything at a very young age. And they also started writing. They were musicians, so they spent a lot of time, working on their music. But I think it's great. And as you said, so even at a young age, you are already doing humanitarian things.
Yes. Yeah, my family was involved in humanitarian things. So I was writing books from a young age and doing humanitarian things from a young age, and it just continued.
And it continued until you write a book, a fantastic book, which I love. I love this cover. I think it's one of the books that I'm going to leave. I have books that I just leave out, on the top of a table, and The Enlightenment of Bees is going to be one that is always going to be hanging around on one of my tables simply because I love the cover so much.
Oh, thank you. I think that cover is one of the most beautiful, cheerful, happy summer covers. And I always say I want a swimsuit that looks like that cover. It's just sort of vintage 1950s black and white or yellow and white stripes black font. It's a fabulous cover. I love it.
It is. And it captures, as you said, it captures the summer, it captures the spirit. And let's talk a little bit about Mia West, your character. We, of course, it's so, in a way, I don't know why I find this funny. It's not funny that she was dumped by her boyfriend. I don't, but for some reason, I get a kick out of this. I don't know why. Must be something sick of. I don't know why it puts a smile on my face. I don't understand this. Tell us about Mia West and what happens to her on her sixth anniversary.
Oh, goodness. Well, the whole story is about an idealistic Seattle baker, Mia, who thinks she's got her entire life planned out, and she's expecting a proposal from her boyfriend of 6 years on their six-year anniversary, and everything, her whole life unexpectedly crumbles in one day, and so she ends up going on an around-the-world humanitarian trip to find her new sweet spot in life. And the funny thing about Mia getting broken up with is that that's very autobiographical. Several things in this story are very autobiographical. It's very dear to my heart. But I think the wonderful thing about writing it now, having lived those sorts of things, is that you can see the good things that are coming. And so you can say, okay, so Mia is broken up with by this guy that really isn't the best fit for her. She's settled for a life that isn't what she is really passionate about, but she loves him and thinks, okay, we'll make this work. And she, this breakup frees her to go on an adventure and actually find the thing that she was meant to do.
Exactly. I don't know. It's so funny. I don't know why I get such a kick out of her, but it's probably because I know that there is so much out there. And because I was, you know, teaching at Sunday school, and these girls, the young girls would all be, you know, this is it. I've got it. I've got my life planned out. This is how it's going to be. And I look at them and I say, okay, you have no idea. You have no idea of what can happen and the opportunities that can open up if you're, you know, just willing to be ready for it.
Totally. And sometimes we think something is a painful ending. And in the midst of those painful endings, often those are the seeds of new beginnings. And we can't see it at the time, but you can look back and go, oh my goodness, this was a really painful thing, but it opened the door for really wonderful things, even better things. And that's what this story is really about.
Yeah, you never know. I mean, I just love it. You know, I think it's good that young girls will read this and they'll say, yeah, you know, this could happen to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going out with this guy and I think he's really great and maybe he's a jerk and maybe he's going to break up with me. So I don't be too devastated by it. What next thing you know, you might land up in Mumbai. Who knows? It's so funny. I think it's so funny. This book, there are so many things about this book I just got a kick out of. Oh. So tell us a little bit about the idea of what was in store for her once she didn't get that ring that she thought she was going to get.
Well, I think, you know, I think so many times we have this idea that to change the world, we need to do something big and grand and dramatic and sort of have a Mother Teresa complex or a savior complex. And that's what Mia has. So she has this idea of herself as Saint Mia, and she's gonna live this selfless life. You know, now that
she's sorry. This book makes me laugh. I love it.
I'm so glad. That's so fun. So she has this idea of herself as this saintly kind of savior, humanitarian savior of the world, and then she goes out and actually experiences international humanitarian aid and experiences these places that she thinks she's gonna go save. And a lot of unexpected things happen to her, and her savior complex is challenged, and she realizes that at the heart of it, it's about people and about pursuing your passions and about trying to help the world authentically and organically from the place where your passions are.
Yes. I think one of the things is because when I was young, when I was very young, I also thought I was going to be a missionary to Africa, and I was going to. It's just so funny. It's just so many things. I just love this book. It's so funny. So from your own perspective, of course, now we know that you yourself have been you're a humanitarian and you've done a lot of good work. And you did your work based out of the UK, is that right?
No, we were mostly based out of Central Europe, post-communist Europe. So we lived most of the time in Budapest.
Ah, okay. Well, that's not a bad place to live.
Oh, no, it's fantastic. Loved that city.
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic. But you actually worked with Syrian refugees.
I did, yeah. So I spent some of the time working with women in trauma, and we were working with a lot of small teams across the Central European region, across 16 countries. I was doing humanitarian aid work with my husband for 7 years in post-communist Europe. And then the refugee crisis started and really reached its peak in 2015 and quite literally came to our doorstep. Syrian and Iraqi refugee families and Afghani families started showing up in our train station on their way from Turkey, from Greece, from Bulgaria, coming up walking sometimes. And we realized that this was a massive humanitarian issue. And when we started realizing this and other people around us started realizing it, no one was doing anything yet about it. There weren't big aid organizations on the ground. So a number of Hungarians banded together and self-sacrificially just started serving these refugees, going to the border of Serbia. They set up a makeshift camp. The government had a few things in place, a couple porta-potties and not much infrastructure because it kind of blindsided them. And these people just stepped into the gap and started helping in the most compassionate way, providing clothes, providing medical aid, providing food. And so I was part of that. I had a 13-month-old son. I would strap him to the front in a baby carrier and load up my little cart with groceries. We loaded up a car and drove it down, just whatever supplies they needed, contributing to that, and then helping distribute, talking to refugees, meeting them as they came up the train tracks from Serbia. And it was an amazing experience and very eye-opening about aid and how things actually happen.
Well, tell us some of the funny stories about aid, because there are a few.
Well, there are a few, yeah, kind of funny and bittersweet and sad. I think I realized during it that there can be a lot of misplaced optimism and a lot of misplaced goodwill. So people really want to help, but sometimes the things they're doing are not the most helpful. And so I remember once I was asked to help sort a whole bunch of clothes that had come from Spain, and some charity in Spain had sent them, but the truck had leaked on the drive from Spain to Hungary. So all of the clothes were completely sopping wet, and we're in the middle of a turnip field. Like, there's no electricity, there's no way to dry these clothes, and these clothes are supposed to be going to refugees. And so we were unloading them and sorting them, and I'm holding up the things that have been donated, and it was like stiletto high heels and gold sequined mini dresses and sheer tops and things. And these are quite conservative, mostly Muslim refugees that were coming through, and we're holding these things up going, okay, this is not culturally appropriate, nor is it appropriate to be walking through Europe in these stiletto heels. Like, these are just not helpful. So, there were some things where it was sort of ironic and a little bit sad and a little bit funny as you're sorting through going, okay, I'm not going to give someone like sopping wet lingerie when they come to finally reach, the Schengen zone and are ready to go on to their new life. So, yeah.
Okay, well, I've had some experience with that kind of stuff, too. And this is so funny. There's lots of things I love in this book. When did you start writing the book itself?
Oh, about 2 years ago. So this one was my first one, Ascension of Larks. I wrote in about 6 years. I had a very leisurely time. That was before I had any publishing contracts. My second one I had partly done when I was given publishing contracts with HarperCollins, Thomas Nelson. And so that one I did in about 2 years. And then this one was the first one that I actually did start to finish in a year, which is, it was good practice to figure out how to be efficient and to write this book quickly.
Well, there are many things I like about this book, as I said. And one of them, of course, is about the grandmother. So tell us about how your grandmother influenced the story.
Oh, my 92-year-old Grandma Sally is the inspiration for the character of Nana Alice in the story. And my grandmother lost my grandfather after a 14-year battle with Alzheimer's disease. And it was a very tough time, difficult for the whole family, especially for her. But after his death, she ended up reconnecting with an old high school friend. They'd known each other when they were 16, and they were drama partners. They can still sing the song, the musical they were in together, their musical number, they can still sing it. And they ended up getting married at the age of 80 in this beautiful senior citizen Cinderella story and traveling the globe for 7 years. They would just globe trot. We would receive an email and they'd say, "We've crossed the Arctic Circle. We're going to, and now we're going down to Antarctica to see the penguins. And now we're in Dubai. And now we're at the Parthenon." And they just went everywhere and had this wonderful, amazing time together. And I always wanted to put that in the story to talk about late in life, second chance at love, and how love can find you in the most unexpected ways and times of life. So I got to put that into The Enlightenment of Bees, and it's just a sweet, again, autobiographical part of me in that story.
Well, I thought it was sweet, as I'm reading this story, because I was, you know, reading it from the point of view that it's for young women. Generally, you know, the reader of this kind of book is a young woman, and many with this idea that they've already got this. They see where they're going to be, you know, in 20 years or 40 years or whatever, and they it generally doesn't work out that way. But I thought that having this story of romance and love at an old age is something that in the back of their minds they can hold this. Yes, you know, all of these things are going to happen in my life. I'm not going to get this job, and I'm not going to marry that guy, and I'm going to, you know, I have all of these things. But maybe in the very, 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 very back, maybe, you know, that first love, you never know, might show up, you know, when I'm 80 years old, for goodness sakes. It's exciting to think about that.
Yeah, I think you never know where life is going to lead you, and that's the beauty of it. The thing I liked about this story is that I actually have a lot of readers who are sort of retirement age, and then sort of the younger set, 30s, 20s, 30s, and I love that this story has something for both of them. So there's this new, Mia's 26, and she's just kind of finding her place in life after heartbreak, and then Nana Alice is finding a new romance in the, you know, the autumn of her life. And so those two
parallel
stories.
This is the winter of her life, honey. This is the
beautiful. It's the winter of her life.
But this is
her life.
It's a fantastic. It's fantastic. And because I know a couple exactly like that, and that's why I get such a kick out of it, because it can happen. In their case, they were together much longer, but they had this same attitude. Do it. I mean, we're old. We can do anything now and just have fun. And I just wish so many more older people would have that attitude. And I hope they'll read this book. As a matter of fact, everybody who gets this book, they should buy one for their grandmother and grandfather.
Yeah.
And say, you know, really buy, absolutely. Don't buy just one book here. Buy two books. And if you don't have a grandmother and grandfather, donate it to one of the, elderly homes, centers, and let them read it. And because it give them hope, why not? They'll look around and they say, you know, I could do that. I could travel to the Arctic. Why not? What the heck? Right?
Mm-hmm. That is a great idea. Yep.
I think so. Everybody should buy two books. I'm telling this to everybody right now. Not one book, two books. Be generous, be kind, share, and give one away to somebody who will really appreciate it. Because older people will get a kick out of it, too, because so many of them will relate to that. Oh, not getting that ring. So you actually, I'm sorry that I'm laughing that you.
Oh, no, it was the best thing ever, because I ended up the broken engagement. It was the best thing for me. I couldn't see it at the time, but I ended up a few years later when I was in graduate school meeting this phenomenal world-traveling, wonderful man who took me on all kinds of adventures, and we just celebrated 11 years of marriage, and I'm so grateful.
Yeah.
And I can't, you know, you can't see it at the moment when you think your life is over, but looking back, I just think, oh, that was the best thing to happen to me.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I can get a kick out of it, because you're not depressed and miserable and lonely.
No, yeah. and sometimes there aren't those happy stories, but for me it was a happy story. And for Mia, it's a happy story because it opens her up to be able to really pursue the things that she's passionate about, and she wouldn't have been able to do that had she stuck with Ethan.
And so one of the things is baking. Baking. Do you like to bake?
I do like to bake. Yeah, I grew up baking with my mother and my grandmother, and I grew up in the Midwest, so baking is a big part of Midwestern culture. And we're right on the border of Amish country, and definitely baking.
Me too. I was making pie crust this morning at six o'clock in the morning.
You get it. Yeah, and honestly, I put food in all of my books. I can't seem to help it. It just sort of goes in there, and now I've embraced it and thought, you know, this is part of what it is. And people love it. I love to write about it. My editor says every time she reads one of my manuscripts, she has to have snacks on hand because she gets so hungry.
I know. That was one of the things I love. There's so many things I love about this book. Do you watch the Great British Bake Off?
Yes, I do. I love that. I find that so relaxing and therapeutic.
Oh, I do. There's nothing like it. It's just, I can take, you know, like I can watch one segment. I really control myself. I say, I'm going to have my morning coffee. I'm going to read one, you know, watch one segment. Just get it, you know, my mind working on something nice. And baking, I started baking when I was with my mother, and I started baking. She'd bake early in the mornings, and that's why this morning I'm making pie crust at 6 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, it's so fun.
That's wonderful.
And there's nothing like feeling that dough in your hands. It's an amazing feeling.
And, you know, as an international aid worker, I was all over the world. I've been to 50 different countries, and baking really centered me. I didn't love it when I was a kid. I thought it was a chore. But when I became an adult, I realized it really connected me to my roots, connected me to those Midwestern roots. And when I bake, I feel like my mother is there. I feel like Grandma Sally's there. And that's a wonderful thing. It's a really warm, connecting thing that I feel really is really empowering, honestly.
And it does connect you to people all over the world. And for example, when you were in Mumbai, tell us a little bit about Mumbai. I don't have too much more time, but I want to hear what you did there.
What I did there, we had a team that was working in slums in India, working with kindergartens and working with kids. So doing something kind of similar to what Mia does in the book, but I think they were doing things a little bit more organically, not making pancakes. Mumbai, I really wrote Mumbai just like Mia experienced it, that it was my first time in India, and it was just, it overwhelmed me. And there was such beauty and such poverty and such, it's just, India is just, there's so much of so many things. And so I wanted to write it from Mia's perspective, that we have a certain idea from postcards and watching movies, and those things can be true, but there's so much more to it. And it's so nuanced. And at the end of the day, making a difference is really about relationships and about people. And so I wanted to really make that clear, that wherever you are in the world, it's really about relationships and people. Whether it's a refugee camp, whether it's Mumbai, that's the heart of it.
Well, I think you captured that. The reason I wanted you to talk a little bit about Mumbai is I thought that I liked that part of the book very much. I think it's I don't know. There's so many things in this book, and I think you've just captured the whole idea of volunteering, trying to make the world a better place, but then also appreciating what you have.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the sweet spot where what we actually love to do can meet the needs of the world and make a difference in an authentic way. And that's what I hope everybody can do. That's what I hope for every reader, that they're thinking, okay, where's my sweet spot? And Mia finds her sweet spot, and it's unexpected. It's not what she thought, but it's definitely what she was meant to do.
And I think your book is, I think it's really fantastic. It's called The Enlightenment of Bees. And it's by Rachel Linden. And once you see this book, you'll buy it. Just the cover will grab you. And it's a fascinating book, Rachel. I think you've done a wonderful job with it. You have a website?
I do. Just www.rachellinden.com.
And if you were giving people advice on how to help the world, what is your one piece of advice?
My one piece of advice is look at the thing that you really love, and then figure out, connect with other people who are doing what you love, and figure out how they're making a difference in the communities or internationally. So don't think, okay, what's the thing that is the biggest need? Think, what's the thing that I have to give, even if it seems small or unusual or you're not sure how it makes a difference, and find out there. I guarantee that somebody else is using that thing to make a difference in the world, and connect with them and figure out how together you can be empowered to change your community and change the world.
Okay. Well, Rachel Linden, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It was a joy to talk to you.
Thank you. It was a joy to talk to you, too. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. This is fun. I had a great day today. Paulina Simmons is the Tiger Catcher. That's book. And get this one now, because on the 23rd, the second book. I like that with a trilogy. One of the things I don't like about trilogies is that you do have to wait sometimes so long before you get to the third book. So in this case, Paulina did it right. She wrote them all. I think she just got carried away with her characters, couldn't stop writing, and wrote them. And now they're all going to be coming out one after another. So it's exciting. And remember what I always tell you, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. And both of these authors today have discovered this. And this is something you can discover. It is never too late. You have to remember, I've had authors on here who are 96 years old, and they come out with books, and you can do it too. And then you might, if you're very lucky, you know, you just hear those magic words. Somebody will say, lights, camera, action. And your book will be turned into a streaming video, a major motion picture, or perhaps on the small screen, which now is, of course, 55 inches for everybody. And you will have a series on perhaps Hallmark Channel, which is what I'm hoping for Carol J. Perry and her books, which are from the Witch City Mysteries. And you never know. But if you don't start writing and just stick to it, persevere, page a day, 2 pages a day, you know, just keep writing. And if you need some inspiration, go to my webpage. It's radio-joyonpaper.com. I have interviews up there with some of the people who have really inspired me recently, because, as I said, when you have authors who are 80 years old and they never wrote a book until they were 75, but they are now writing and they are having fun, and you can do it too. And again, my webpage is radio-joyonpaper.com. Everybody have a wonderful, wonderful weekend, and start writing and say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything, and everybody. Just enjoy yourselves. Be good to people today. Bye-bye now.